What is Circle? At Circle, we're building a digital dollar that brings the power of the internet to money. Circle's the place where crypto meets stability, where local businesses meet global customers, and the U.S. dollar meets USDC. Visit circle.com/podcast.
State Farm is committed to being your top choice when insuring the things that matter to you. My Cultura podcast host, Dramos, also believes in the power of financial knowledge. That's why he makes sure to share his financial tips on his podcast, Life as a Gringo.
Financial freedom usually means having enough savings, financial investments, and cash on hand to afford the kind of life we desire for ourselves and our families.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Learn more at es.statefarm.com. State Farm is a proud partner of the My Cultura Podcast Network.
Big news, country fans. Ram Trucks is coming back to the iHeart Country Festival Saturday, May 13th in Austin, Texas. And this year, the highlight of the show will definitely be the We're All Country guitar pull, powered by Ram Trucks, featuring performances by country music's biggest names. Like these stars, Ram owners have heart for being fearless, determined, and bold. That's why it's time for you to be a Ram. Check out what the 2023 Ram 1500 has to offer by visiting ram.com today.
This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and you're about to hear the story of a guitarist extraordinaire, Tommy Tedesco, a member of a group of the most sought-after musicians in the world, dubbed the Wrecking Crew. Tommy played on thousands of recordings from the 1960s to 80s, many of them top 20 hits you know. Yet, he never earned the household name status he deserved. He was, as one critic said, the most famous guitarist you've never heard of. Tommy's son, filmmaker Denny Tedesco, sought to fix this and made the movie The Wrecking Crew, a terrific documentary about his father and the other musicians who made up this remarkable band. Let's begin with Denny Tedesco, a great tribute by a son to a father.
In the 1960s, there were a group of studio musicians in Los Angeles that became known as the Wrecking Crew. Now, I call them the melting pot of America's pop music. Italians, Jews, Irish, black, classically trained jazz musicians, country musicians, hillbilly, and one woman. Now, together for a few years in the mid-1960s, they ruled the Billboard charts with their recordings. They were a hidden secret among music buyers and listeners, but they were revered by artists, producers, and engineers. If a pop artist recorded in LA in the 1960s, most likely many of these, if not all these studio musicians, were involved in the recording. They recorded with the Beach Boys, Elvis, Fit Dimension, The Byrds, Jan and Dean, Mamas and Papas, The Monkees, Frank and Nancy Sinatra, Sam Cooke, The Ronettes, Righteous Brothers, and so many more. Why am I telling you this story? Well, one of those Italian guitar players, Tommy Tedesco, was my father. My name is Denny Tedesco. Some of the other voices you will hear comes from the documentary The Wrecking Crew. But before I tell you more about my father and his friends, you need to know what came before to lead up to their success. In the 1950s and early 60s, the music scene was changing and rock and roll couldn't be ignored. As generations and cultures clashed, so did the music. In 1960, rock and roll was at its infancy, and there was doubt among the parents and the older generation that the music would even last. Even record companies would take their time putting their toes into the rock and roll pool. One of the first changes in the record world was in the 1950s. There was a transition from the 78 RPM record format to the 45 RPM, which really represented the pop recording. In 1958, the 45 disc replaced the 78 completely. The first time you'll hear the term top 40 is in 1960. Hear producer Snuff Garrett tell the story.
Todd Storr is a day drinker, and he would sit in this local bar and sit there all day and drink. One day, after a year or so, he was sitting there thinking about it. How many records are on that jukebox? Because everybody plays the same five or six records all the time. He went over and looked, and there was 100 records on the jukebox, and he thought, out of the 100 records, why do they keep playing those five or six all the time, you know? And they figured out that and said, well, maybe people just want to hear the hits. They don't want to hear this or that or whatever. They want to hear the same songs over and over. So he and Gordon McClendon talked on the phone and invented Top 40 Radio.
With radio featuring top hit singles, there was a demand for product, and record companies needed to supply that demand. Now, you have to realize the main commercial pop recordings were coming out of New York, Nashville, Detroit, London in the late 50s and early 60s. LA had a very established recording business, but it was really overshadowed by the film business. Here is producer Lou Adler to tell you more.
I mean, they didn't recognize what was happening in LA music, the film people. It was much later that they started to even think about this would be a good soundtrack to have. You know, we can not only have a film that has good grosses, we can make money on a soundtrack. I think they didn't respect the music business for a very long time, even when it was successful in LA.
The recording studio musicians of the time were keeping busy, but not so much by the pop scene. Movie and television soundtracks kept many employed, and the West Coast jazz scene became to be known as the cool sound. But things started to change when artists like Sam Cooke, Jan and Dean, The Beach Boys, and Phil Spector started to have hits in the early 1960s. Labels started to see the tide turn, so they started signing new acts. Like any business, you want to make sure you don't overextend on a budget and put the odds of success in your favor. And the music business at the time did exactly that. Many of the artists in the early 1960s were singers, so the labels would hire producers who turned around and hired session musicians to record the music. So in comes a generation of musicians that were hungry to break into the studio scene. As I said earlier, they came from all kinds of backgrounds. My father came from Niagara Falls, New York, with my mom and older brother in 1953. Here's a clip of my mother telling this story.
We went to the prom and Ralph Martiri was playing the dance and found out that their guitar player was leaving that night. And he tried out, auditioned, and he was hired right then and there. It was on a Friday night, and a Saturday night he left for New York City. Okay, he got let go. Martiri was going to get a guitar singer so that he could only pay for one guy. He decided he knew there was nothing there in Niagara Falls for him. He wanted to go to California to play.
While my father struggled to find work playing guitar, he had to make ends meet working in a warehouse. He always said it was the best job he ever had. He hated it so much, it made him practice every day.
I was told by two guys before we left, he's never gonna make it. So after 7 months of struggling here, Daddy wanted to go back. And I said, there's no way, because I wasn't giving in to those two guys. And that's what Dad said, my stubborn Sicilian wife.
And you're listening to Denny Tedesco tell the story of his father, Tommy Tedesco. We continue with this remarkable story and a remarkable tribute by a son to a father here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Don't miss the opportunity to give your mom, your wife, your daughter, or even yourself the best gift ever. A good night's sleep and something cozy that'll be used every day. Luxurious bedding and loungewear from CozyEarth.com. Shop Mother's Day now at CozyEarth.com. Use promo code PODCAST35 for up to 35% off site-wide. The biggest savings ever. Cozy Earth fabric is so unbelievably soft, so unforgettably comfortable. CozyEarth.com products are made from responsibly sourced viscose from bamboo. Feels like heaven to the touch, and their premium fabric regulates her body temperature. keeps her feeling just right no matter the season. Check everyone off your list this Mother's Day. Be sure to use promo code PODCAST35 for an unheard of 35% off, but only for a limited time. So order today. Shop for Mother's Day now at CozyEarth.com for best selection and use promo code PODCAST35 to save up to 35% off site-wide. That's CozyEarth.com.
What is Circle? First of all, it's a beautiful shape. It's consistent. A community. It's meant to be inclusive. The globe. At Circle, we build USDC, a digital dollar that's actually dollar-backed, one-to-one. We're building a future where money will travel at the speed of the internet for fractions of a penny, and no one will think about it because it will just be the way we work. Circle's the place where crypto meets stability, where local businesses meet global customers, and the U.S. dollar meets USDC. Visit circle.com/podcast.
Most TVs are smart nowadays, but with busy home screens and remotes with too many or too few buttons, smart shouldn't mean complicated. That's why Roku TV is the smart TV made easy. The customizable home screen puts your inputs, streaming favorites like iHeart, and free live TV all in one place. From simple settings anyone can understand, automatic updates with the latest features, and much more, Roku TV is more than a smart TV. It's a better TV. Learn more today at Roku.com. Happy streaming.
And we continue with our American stories. And now let's return to Denny Tedesco.
While my father struggled to find work playing guitar, he had to make ends meet working in a warehouse. He always said it was the best job he ever had. He hated it so much, it made him practice every day.
In fact, my wife was behind me 100%. Never complained. My wife accepted it. This was our living. Our whole family took it exactly that way. Every once in a while, a musician's wife would come and complain to her, and she'd talk to them. She'd say, well, look, that's his living.
I was very jealous of the guitar when we were first dating and got engaged, and he paid a lot more attention to the guitar, I felt. So I gave him an ultimatum. It's me or the guitar. And he said, honey, the guitar doesn't have legs, you do. He got so upset with him, I took my ring and I threw it at him. Then I went looking for it.
So my father, who was a gambler, drove cross country with his family. With very little money in their pockets, it was the greatest gamble of his life that paid off. Many of the other musicians that became known as Wrecking Crew were Hal Blaine, Earl Palmer, Jim Gordon on drums, Don Randy, Leon Russell, Al DeLore, Larry Nechtel on piano. On bass were Joe Osborne, Ray Pullman, Carol Kaye, Lyle Ritz, and other guitarists that sat alongside my father included Glenn Campbell, Bill Pittman, Barney Kessel, Lou Morrell, Billy Strange, and many others. The Wrecking Crew wasn't a band per se. Each individual was hired as individuals. Here is Hal Blaine, Tommy Tedesco, and the engineers from Gold Star, Larry Levine, Dave Gold, and Stan Ross, talking about the genesis of the name.
You know, all the guys that had been in the studios, God bless them all, for 20, 30 years, they all wore the blue blazers, the neckties, and there was no talking, no smoking, and no nothing. And we came in there with Levi's and t-shirts, smoking cigarettes, whatever, weird.
Yeah.
And the older guys were saying, they're going to wreck the business. You know, they are going to wreck the music business. Well, that's how that whole Wrecking Crew thing came in.
Even though the term The Wrecking Crew gained popularity with rock historians, many of these musicians never heard the term until years later. There were a few reasons the older guys were putting it down. Remember, many of the established studio musicians were from the old school big bands, and they were busy working in lucrative careers in soundtracks. When the labels started pushing some of the younger acts, they would create demos first. Now, the older musicians wanted to take a chance on taking over a demo session because it was illegal in the views of the musician union. Why take a chance when you're working on a movie for a three-hour gig that paid less? But for some of the younger guys, it was an opportunity to get involved with new producers and new artists. Once these guys became so in demand, from that point on, most of the recordings became legit union dates. One of the producers who hired these guys was Phil Spector when he moved back to the West Coast. That seems to be the anchor that changed so much for the musicians as well as the music scene. Here are the voices of Hal Blaine, Carol Kaye, Plaz Johnson, and Cher talking about Phil Spector.
Hello, let's go. Let's make one more, huh?
One,
three.
One, two, three.
Well, it's wall-to-wall musicians, first of all.
Yeah.
Most people use a four-piece rhythm section. He had four guitars, or six, or seven. There were four pianos always. One upright bass, one Fender bass. I mean, it was only one drums, usually. 15 people playing percussion instruments.
In a very small room.
Yeah.
A small room, but an average room.
And a huge echo chamber that Gold Star was famous for.
Ceramic.
That was the walls.
Ceramic walls.
You know, Philip was walking in a different universe than everybody else. And so in his mind, it was all him, you know, and the guys were just some sort of an extension of what he couldn't do.
Phil loved jazz guitars. So in the guitar section, he would have my father, Barney Kessel, Bill Pittman, Carol Kay, Howard Roberts, and a few others. Phil could be hard to get along with for many, but my father seemed to be able to deal with him in his own way. Here's my father talking about his first time working with Phil.
It was the first time I've been hearing Phil Spector's name with all the guys. I didn't know anything about him. All I know is every word for him. So I went on this job.
It was like group therapy.
And all of a sudden, I worked for about a half hour, an hour. There was no break, a little longer. Finally says, hey, when do you take a break here? Everybody looked at me like I'm nuts, saying this to Phil, you know. I'm looking at Phil, when do we take a break here? Yeah, when he says, when I'm in New York, Kenny Burrell never asks for, time. I said, oh, you're starting that New York jazz
boy. No, that's all. You were his friend for life.
Well, then, you know, yeah. But it was real funny. Like, I was the only one that ever must have talked to him like this.
Yeah.
You know,
So
after that, it's okay, take a break. Yeah. And the next thing you know, I was like a friend of his. I was doing, he says, you want to go out for coffee?
Yeah.
He never asked nobody for coffee. And I'm going with him and his bodyguard.
Here is a telegram that Phil sent my father in the mid-60s when Phil traveled to New York. I was in my New York hotel room changing channels when I came across the Lawrence Welk show. And what do I see? Two beady Sicilian eyes in the band. What is a hip Hollywood guitar player doing on the Lawrence Welk show? My father turned around and sent a telegram back. His response was, what is a hip Hollywood producer watching Lawrence Welk for? The gravy train was moving fast and you didn't turn anything down. Many times, if a new band was going into the studio, the producer would still use these session musicians. They usually weren't allowed to play on the album because studio time was expensive and the producers had to make sure that they could get in and get out with the recording. Now, recording technology in the early 60s didn't allow for mistakes. If you had 10 to 15 players in a room, they all had to nail their parts. There were no computers helping you punch in. If you made a mistake, they would just start from the beginning and go for it. Glenn Campbell described it like this. He said, it was like playing with Michael Jordan, but everybody in the room was a Michael Jordan. One of these groups that had their instruments stripped from them at the door were the Byrds, when they recorded Mr. Tambourine Man. Here's Roger McGuinn telling us the story.
Terry Melcher wanted to use session musicians for Mr. Tambourine Man. I'd been a studio musician in New York prior to being in the Byrds, so they let me play on it. So my feeling was, great, I get to play with this great band, the Wrecking Crew. Of course, the other guys, David Crosby and Michael Clark and Chris Hillman, were livid. They hated the idea because they didn't get to play on their own record. We got a number one hit with it right off the bat, but we knocked out two tracks in 1 3-hour session. To compare that with what happened when the rest of the band got to play, it took us 77 takes to get the band track for Turn, 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 which was also number one.
Here's Carol Kay and my father.
Here's the way that the beat goes on sounded when we first heard it. La-di-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-di-di-di-di-di. I said, uh-oh, we need to pull a rabbit out of a hat for this one. You know, it was our job to come up with riffs and stuff. So about the third line I came up with was... Da-da-da-da-da. You know. And Sonny loved it, and he gave it to Bob West, the bass player, to play it, and both of us are playing it throughout the tune. And without a good bass line, the tune doesn't pop, you know, it doesn't snap, you know, like a big hit record.
I've always said, they put notes on paper. They put notes on paper, but that's not music. You make the music. What do you do with the notes?
Right.
What do you do with the charts? What do you do with the chords?
Other than that, they can call a union for a guitar.
That's right. So it's what you put into it, because how many days, in fact, we're all here.
It's what you put into it that's not written.
Yeah. Well, in fact, everybody can that's sitting here. I remember doing different things that weren't ever even thought about, and then all of a sudden become part of the record and part of the signature.
We all used to produce our own parts. Oh, yeah, it's that simple.
To make it swing, yeah.
I'll never forget working with Gary Luce and his Playboys doing all the records.
Sure.
And I'll never forget I had one real hot lick on this one record, the Spanish stuff all over the place.
Guess you could say my love was blind.
And finally, his guitar player come up to me and says, oh, you drove me crazy with that thing. First of all, I can't play it, so I don't play it. And then everybody comes up to me complimenting me on what I did on it. I said, well, just take the compliments and forget it.
And you're listening to Denny Tedesco celebrating and honoring his father. More of Tommy Tedesco's story brought to us by his son, Denny, here on Our American Stories.
What is Circle? First of all, it's a beautiful shape. It's consistent. A community. It's meant to be inclusive. The globe. At Circle, we build USDC, a digital dollar that's actually dollar-backed, one-to-one. We're building a future where money will travel at the speed of the internet for fractions of a penny, and no one will think about it because it will just be the way we work. Circle's the place where crypto meets stability, where local businesses meet global customers, and the US dollar meets USDC. Visit circle.com/podcast.
With so many streaming devices out there today, what sets Roku apart? Roku players are made for one thing, to get you the entertainment you want quick and easy. That means a simple home screen with your favorites front and center, channels like iHeartRadio that launch in a snap, and curated selections of TV for when you only sort of know what to watch. Not to mention all the free TV you can stream, including over 300 free live channels on the Roku channel. Find the perfect Roku player for you today at Roku.com. Happy streaming.
Nissan is driving the thrill of its vehicle's innovative design into the spotlight in Thrilling Design, the brand's latest campaign. Nissan dares to design what others won't by approaching each project in a completely different way. They break molds and start each design with a specific customer in mind and how this vehicle will bring a unique sense of thrill to the road. The campaign illustrates how Nissan drives to build an exhilarating experience into each model from initial concept to the last bolt, with each design inspired by what moves and thrills you. We get a look into where Nissan draws inspiration for its innovative vehicle lineup and unique models to get a closer look at the thrilling details, features, and silhouettes. The Nissan Z, Ariya, and Rogue models take center stage to show everyday adventures Nissan vehicles can inspire, with appearances by the rugged Pathfinder and bold Altima SR as well. Nissan is driving the thrill of its vehicle's innovative design into the spotlight in Thrilling Design, the brand's latest campaign. To learn more about the design and innovation at Nissan, visit www.nissanusa.com.
And we continue with Our American Stories and Denny Tedesco's story of his father, guitarist Tommy Tedesco. Here's Wrecking Crew bassist Carol Kay to continue with this remarkable story.
We learned how to play rock and roll right there on the job. Hey, you know, if they want this, I can do it. You know, that's Latin music. That's nothing. Yeah. You can do that all day long.
Here's producer Bones Howe, Glenn Campbell, Brian Wilson, Hal Blaine, Earl Palmer, and Dick Clark.
These are the guys that played on Windy and Never My Love and Everything That Touches You and all the things that were in those two albums that I did with them. Those are all those studio musicians. It's Hal, Joe, Larry, Tommy, and those guys. I wanted to put their names on the back of the album when it was finished, and they wouldn't let me because they said, well, we don't want those kids out there that buy our records to know that we didn't play on the record.
I went out and took Brian's place with the Beach Boys. And I can understand probably why Brian had studio guys come in. There's a lot of them would fight like cats and dogs, man. Rather than Brian to go through the hassle to get the tracks, he would hire the rhythm section to come in and do the tracks.
Well, the guys, well, they at first they were a little jealous, you know what I mean? But I explained to them, I said, you know, I want to get the best I can get for the group. And they go, well, I can understand your point, Brian, you know? So we went ahead and did it, and sure enough, the guys liked it.
I mean, that's one of the most asked questions. Well, didn't Dennis get mad? Wasn't he mad because you were doing the Beach Boys records? Dennis did not have the studio chops that we had. Yeah. You know, the proof of the pudding is that Dennis called me to do his album when Dennis did his solo album. I played the drums on it.
A lot of times the guys would be sitting around the studio. We didn't know that there were guys in the band. The guitar players that were in these various groups, when they realized guys like Tommy Tedesco was going to be playing, they wanted to sit around and watch. And the drummers would want to sit around and watch myself or Al. They were there like more or less they were learning. You know, it would be something that I'd like to see too if it had been the other way around.
Nobody cared. All they wanted was the product. They just wanted the name and the sales. Who created it? That was incidental.
My father would say there are only four reasons to take a gig. For the money, for the connections, for the experience, or just for fun.
I got to tell you a story about your dad. We were in Western Studio 3 there, and Jan Barry of Jan and Dean, he counted the song. Everybody ready? Yeah, okay. Tedesco started playing. And Jan said, stop, wait. And he went over and looked, and he said, Tedesco, what are you doing? Tommy, the music was upside down, and Tommy was reading it backwards. Now, that's a true story, but you talk about getting a laugh out of it. Tommy was a cut-up.
A session or a recording date, as they called it, would be 3 hours long. Now, the musicians would go to work many times not knowing what they were recording or whom they were recording with. Most of the time, the music was just written out, but many times they would have to come up with ideas that worked for a song. In 1968, Jimmy Webb gave my father a charm modeled like a tiny Grammy Award as a thank you gift. My father asked, "What is this for?" Jimmy told him it was for winning the Grammy for Up, Up, and Away with the Fifth Dimension. My father didn't even realize he was on the track. Now you have to realize, when they went to work, they were given sheet music and then they would just start playing. The songs weren't hits yet, just another tune. Many times they would just record tracks and the vocals would be laid in later. If you look at my father's workbooks from the 60s, he was working 3 to 4 recordings a day. Now the union allowed them to record only 3 to 4 songs per 3 hours, so you can imagine the amount of music they were given. So to remember what was recorded the week before could be very difficult. Now many people assume it was like one big hootenanny and jam session at my house growing up. It was actually just the opposite. I never saw my father pick up his guitar to practice or play at home until the 70s, when he was doing his own jazz records. The last thing he wanted to do was to play or even listen to music when he came home. He didn't need to practice. He was working 12 hours a day. I knew my father went to work playing guitar, but I never comprehended how different that was to other kids' dads and moms. Other friends' dads went to work with hammers and saws in their trucks. In my dad's trunk, it was packed with a Fender Telecaster, steel string acoustic, a classical, a mandolin, a banjo, a 12-string, and an amp. A trick my father would use when it came to getting all those oddball guitar gigs was listing himself on multiple guitar sections in the union book. If a composer asked his contractor to see who played Bela Lyka or Bouzouki, they would look into the union book and see many unknown Greek and Russian names, and then they come across Tedesco. Now, my father did play all those instruments. The difference was he tuned every one of them like a guitar. If you played more than one guitar on a session, you were paid more. It was called doubling. The first guitar was 100%, the second 50%, and the others were 25% of the session rate. One day, my father was recording the show The Love Boat, which was traveling through the Mediterranean. So he was in hog heaven working with various guitars. One of the violinists in the orchestra called out sarcastically to Tommy, "Tommy, do you even know the names of those instruments?" He stood up and picked each one up and proudly said, "Yep, 100%, 50%, 25%, and so on." Here is my father at a seminar in 1983 at Musicians Institute, talking about Spanish guitar.
Let me give you what I call the creative studio guitar player. About a year ago, I got the call to do a John Denver special. It was John Denver in Mexico, and they wanted some, he was on a fishing vessel, and they wanted some Mexican music, so I gave him this. Charlie's Angels. They were in Puerto Rico. They wanted Puerto Rican music, so I gave them this. Starsky and Hutch was in a big revolt in Bolivia on one show. They wanted Bolivian music.
The record industry started to change in the late 1960s. Technology changed, which allowed more tracks, which gave a lot more leeway for producing. Bands were self-sufficient, and soon it was about the singer-songwriter era. The artists had more to say in the production of the music, and many times they brought their own players. But when the 1970s came around, many of the Wrecking Crew players went in different directions. Some went on the road with various artists and groups, and some went into teaching. My father's career was extended well into the 80s, working on television and film scores. Someone asked him in an interview a few years before he passed, what piece of music would you want to be remembered for? Sure, he played on some iconic guitar leads like Batman theme, Green Acres, Bonanza, and worked with everyone from Frank Sinatra and Elvis to the Beach Boys and the Mamas and Papas. But many times, any of the other eight guitar players could have recorded the same pieces. But what he was most proud of was some of the films he worked on with the great composers, John Williams, James Horner, Jerry Goldsmith, Bill Conti, Henry Mancini, and others. Many times, John Williams or James Horner would put a hold on him a couple months in advance. That's when he knew he made it.
And you're listening to Denny Tedesco telling the remarkable story of his dad, honoring his dad. And we thank Denny for doing all this work. Check out the DVD and other Wrecking Crew items like CDs, books, and other merchandise at WreckingCrewFilm.com and use the discount code AmericanStory. Watch this documentary, folks. It is American music from 1960 to 1980 and a lot of stories you didn't get to hear here. More of Denny Tedesco honoring his father, Tommy, here on Our American Stories.
Digital currency is helping to form the base layer for a new global commerce infrastructure. And stablecoins like USDC, issued by Circle, help to bring faster payments at internet scale. From merchants at the point of sale to corporations that want to pay global suppliers and even employees more efficiently. Visit circle.com/podcast to learn more.
Most TVs are smart nowadays, but with busy home screens and remotes with too many or too few buttons, smart shouldn't mean complicated. That's why Roku TV is the smart TV made easy. The customizable home screen puts your inputs, streaming favorites like iHeart, and free live TV all in one place. From simple settings anyone can understand, automatic updates with the latest features, and much more, Roku TV is more than a smart TV. It's a better TV. Learn more today at Roku.com. Happy streaming.
Nissan is driving the thrill of its vehicle's innovative design into the spotlight in Thrilling Design, the brand's latest campaign. Nissan dares to design what others won't by approaching each project in a completely different way. They break molds and start each design with a specific customer in mind and how this vehicle will bring a unique sense of thrill to the road. The campaign illustrates how Nissan drives to build an exhilarating experience into each model from initial concept to the last bolt, with each design inspired by what moves and thrills you. We get a look into where Nissan draws inspiration for its innovative vehicle lineup and unique models to get a closer look at the thrilling details, features, and silhouettes. The Nissan Z, Ariya, and Rogue models take center stage to show everyday adventures Nissan vehicles can inspire with appearances by the rugged Pathfinder and bold Altima SR as well. Nissan is driving the thrill of its vehicle's innovative design into the spotlight in Thrilling Design, the brand's latest campaign. To learn more about the design and innovation at Nissan, visit www.nissanusa.com.
And we continue with Denny Tedesco's tribute to his father, Tommy, here on Our American Stories. Now let's return to Denny Tedesco for this final installment of this remarkable tribute.
He used to say, "I play for smiles. If a leader or the artist is smiling, I'm doing my job. I might play something I think is better suited, but in the end, if he isn't smiling, I better think of something else." Father used to say there's music and then there's the music business. Sometimes they mix, but not always. He said he was the luckiest guy in the world. He never thought he'd make a living at his instrument. He always felt you're a part of a minority as a working musician. And then he became part of a smaller minority making a living as a session musician. When he was asked if he should have been paid more for his contributions, he would say, "I worked on hundreds of hits, but I worked on thousands of bombs. So I never gave the guy that had the bomb his money back. So it all worked out." In 1993, my father had a stroke that basically ended his career as a guitar player. It was devastating. He survived and he came back, but his right hand wasn't the same. He still picked up the guitar, but he would never record again. The last movie he worked on was Schindler's List. In 1996, my father was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. They gave him less than a year. We were stunned as a family, but not surprised. My dad had quit smoking in 1980, but my father smoked 3 packs a day. He didn't really drink and he hated drugs. He wasn't philosophically opposed if others participated, but he never liked being out of control or not mentally sharp. But he had his vices. They were the cigarettes, the pasta, the coffee, and the gambling. Many times he could do all 4 at the same time. Before this diagnosis, I played around with the idea to tell the story about the musicians of the 60s. So when my dad was diagnosed, I realized if I didn't make a move quickly, I would never have the chance to tell that story. At this point in my life, I was working on IMAX films as a grip coordinator. I wasn't a director, but I knew my friends and my wife Susie, who was a producer, would be there to support my dream of telling the story. Now the first day of shooting, I brought together drummer Hal Blaine, bassist Carol Kay, saxophone player Plaz Johnson, and my dad. It was the first time probably in 25 years that all 4 had been in the room together. I was shooting 16mm film and had 2 cameras on 2 dollies constantly circling. I was in heaven. They sat at the round table and they just started talking. I would throw out a couple of questions and they would just go from there. You have to realize the only time I really ever saw my father's friends were at poker games, golf games, or parties. I never went to work with my dad. So when I brought the 4 of these characters together, it was magic. The stories, the laughter, the teasing, the joking was amazing. It was still early in my father's disease, so he still had a lot of energy and spunk. It played out exactly like I envisioned it that day.
One of the guys, yeah.
His sexual harassment suits were in there. She'd be 7 millionaires right now after what we put her through. She'd have all the lawyers working for against us.
I don't think anyone ever really felt that she was a woman, and I don't mean that detrimentally.
No, we were musicians.
Yeah.
Everything was music, really.
Yeah. Worse than that would have been shutting her out and not sharing the camaraderie.
People ask me all the time about being a woman in the man's world. I felt equal with the rest of the guys, and they felt it too. Sometimes they got a little testy. They say, "Oh, you play good for a girl, Carol." Yeah, and you play good for a guy too. I love musicians and the humor and the way that they play, and they all knew that. And I think it was like a sister, having a sister there.
Dad passed a few months later. He never got to see 1 minute of the film. After he passed, I continued interviewing anyone that I was able to get to. The hardest part in making a documentary is getting past the gatekeepers. The gatekeeper's job is to stop folks like me. I'm asking them to give me 30 minutes to an hour of an interview. Now that's a dream, by the way. To sit down and let me ask them questions for no money. But if I could get past the gatekeeper and get to the artist through the back door, I knew I had a chance of major interviews. So you have to realize that these major stars like Cher, Brian Wilson, and others were only kids when they were working with my father and his friends. So they looked up to the musicians, nothing but fond memories. People always ask me if I received any financial help from others in the making of the film. Other than family, I say no. But I did actually get help from Wells Fargo, Countrywide, American Express, B of A, and other financial institutions who were more than willing to give me credit cards and refis. Well, that turned into a disaster. Soon the market crashed and I had a load of debt with nothing to show for it but a bunch of interviews. I don't recommend making any film this way. Now, there were all kinds of ideas how to trim the budget. People who hadn't seen the film came up with ideas that started from the practical to the absurd. Some would say just use less songs. Use 20 instead of 110. But what does the Beach Boys, Frank Sinatra, the Byrds, Fit Dimension, Sam Cooke, and the Chipmunks have in common? Some of the same musicians. So you need to show the quantity of music that was coming out of LA at the time. As I say, I had to show quantity, not necessarily quality. At this point, my wife Susie was concerned we made the most expensive home movie ever. And that's where it was in 2006. So we had to go for it. We hired an editor, producer, Claire Scanlon, to come in and help us put the film together. Claire and I cut the first 30 minutes together and showed it to our friend Grady Cooper, who looked at it and made a very stinging comment. His comment was, "Hey, it's good, but why are you making this story? What I just saw in this cut, any of us could do this." What he meant was, I wasn't taking advantage of something I was avoiding, the connection to the film, my father. And I was avoiding that fact. My ego was getting to me. I wanted to be known as the director, not the son of the subject. I finally gave in, and it changed everything from that point on. Finally, in 2014, I paid everyone off and was finally picked up by Magnolia Pictures. It screened in theaters around the world and was on Netflix and continues to play on Hulu, YouTube, and other platforms. Someone asked me if I learned anything about my father in the making of this. While many stories I heard sometimes sounded like folklore, musicians would always describe a recording as if it was like a legendary World Series game, with an orchestra playing and my father had the lead. He would play a hard piece of music as if he owned it and wrote it himself. It made me very proud. But one of my favorite stories I would like to leave you with says it all. This came from one of the greatest bass players in the world, Chuck Rainey. A few years after my father passed, I went to interview Chuck, who told me this story. I had never heard it before.
We're at Fox, recording the music for these four segments of MASH. In one of the titles, he wrote something in the ledger lines on the bass clef, which has always been somewhat of my weakness. So we start recording it, we get to this part, and I make a mistake. I flub it. Tommy goes, now I knew who he was. Wow, I'm glad that somebody else made a mistake rather than me. Run it back, and they say, Tommy, you all right? Tommy said, and he was Tommy Tedesco. So I said, phew, somebody else had a problem with this. Run the tape back, start it again, we get to the same place, and I make a mistake again on this particular part. And Tommy goes, and so the producer says, Tommy, all right, he says, it's okay. I'm going, phew. And he turns to me and he says, that's the last time. Then I realized that he's doing me a favor. He's hearing me mess it up. He did this twice and put it on him. And so on the break, we go to the break room. And he says, man, I'm Tedesco, Tom Tedesco. He says, you know, it's great to work with you. I heard a lot about you. And he says, don't get scared. He says, fear does that. And thanks for saving me. He said, no problem at all, man, no problem at all. You know, you're a good player, you're here for a reason. Because it's a first call band. You know, you're here for a reason. And I remember I got in my car going back home. I said, what a nice gesture from a real nice guy to do that for me. You know, because I've seen other people really come down hard on other musicians, especially if they were new. But it's just so kind, the way he went.
I realize that I'm very lucky. I had a great relationship with my dad. Sometimes you wouldn't think so. We would argue all the time. Not sure about what, but we both knew how to push each other's buttons. But as soon as he was diagnosed with cancer, we never argued again. Just a few weeks before he passed away, he said to me, you know, the stroke came at the right time in my life. I knew exactly what he meant. The phone had stopped ringing, and his day as the LA session king came to an end. But now he had an excuse of why the phone didn't ring, and it wasn't something that he had control over. Now, if I learned anything from my father, it was to always give more than you take. I mean, he loved his family and friends, and he would always help the younger guitar players, knowing it was just a matter of time before they would take his place, just like he took someone else's place 40 years earlier. Miss you, Dad.
And a special thanks to Denny Tedesco for that beautiful story honoring his father, Tommy Tedesco. Check out the DVD and other Wrecking Crew items like CDs, books, and other merchandise at WreckingCrewFilm.com and use the discount code AmericanStory. That's discount code AmericanStory at WreckingCrewFilm.com. By the way, as he put it, what turned into the most expensive home movie ever made to this remarkable film on Magnolia Pictures, Netflix, and available online is the insight that he needed to do a movie as a son and not as some auteur or some artist. And it changed everything. And my goodness, to have a dad like this, there are two kinds of dads, folks. And I'll say it over and over again. The dad who gets a documentary or a story like this from a son, and the dad who doesn't. This is Our American Stories.
You wouldn't settle for watching a blurry TV, would you? So why settle for just okay TV sound? Upgrade your streaming and sound all in one with Roku Stream Bar. This powerful 2-in-1 upgrade for any TV lets you stream your favorite entertainment in brilliant 4K HDR picture and hear every detail with auto speech clarity. Whether you're hosting a party or just cleaning the house, turn it up and rock out with iHeartRadio and room-filling sound. Learn more about Roku Stream Bar today at Roku.com. Happy streaming.
I'm Malcolm Gladwell. I live way out in the country. I drive everywhere. And you know what scares me? That feeling of finding myself stuck on the side of the road. But now, all of us can avoid that pain by getting our vehicle the part it needs before that breakdown oh-no moment. With eBay Guaranteed Fit and over 122 million parts and accessories, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. For the parts and accessories that fit your vehicle, just look for the green check. Get the right parts, the right fit, and the right prices. ebaymotors.com. Let's ride. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Inspired by Ubisoft's famous video game series Assassin's Creed, the Echoes of History podcast offers a deep and fascinating dive into history. In this season's Assassin vs. Templars, these two organizations have a rich history that takes its root in the medieval era and the time of the Crusades within the Assassin's Creed universe. Hosted by Dan Snow and Matt Lewis from History Hit, each episode offers us a history of these two not-so-secret societies. New episodes weekly. Listen to Echoes of History, Assassins vs. Templars on iHeart or wherever you get your podcasts.